Everything had to be my way. And this is where we've ended up. And it's all because of me that we're here now. Hungry and cold and hunted. I love you, Mom. And Dad. I'm so sorry.
Students vanish after traveling into a Maryland forest to film a documentary on the local Blair Witch legend, leaving only their footage behind. Ladies and gentlemen, of course, by that I mean, tonight we are talking about the infamous, the classic, the biggest indie film of all time, The Blair Witch Project, 1999's horror, whether, depending on who you are, either a masterpiece or a nostalgic ride that ends, you know, kind of there. Let's start the show off with a definitive statement, and that is the Blair Witch 2 is awful. It is a terrible film. I'm waiting for Tanner. Tanner, shut your lips. I'm waiting for Tanner to try to defend it and explain to me why I'm wrong about the Blair Witch 2. Okay, he's shaking his head. That's good. Let's start it off. My name is Shannon Young. I'm going to be your host tonight. With me, of course, of Hunter Hendricks.
I'm going to go ahead and start here. The Blair Witch is the 13th biggest indie movie of all time. Not the biggest in any way, shape, or form.
It's funny. I couldn't hear the click of your keyboard when you did that. I don't know. I don't know how you did it without doing that. And then Tanner Calvert.
You're not going to like what's number one.
The number one indie film of all time?
Mm-hmm.
Well, hold on. Tanner Calvert's also here with us.
I am, and also the sequel to Blair Witch is not called Blair Witch 2. It's just called Blair Witch.
There's only two movies, Shannon. Book of Shadows. Hunter, what are the 13 biggest indie films of all time? I need to know. What's above Blair Witch?
So I'll count them down from Blair Witch, which is the 13th one, down to number one.
So I would assume, real quick before you say that, is Paranormal Activity above Blair Witch?
It is not. It was okay. So the reason it's not on the list there is that it was co-distributed by a major studio.
Yeah. Okay.
Same goes for Inglourious Basterds. So Blair Witch Project is 13 as far as the highest grossing indie films of all time. Below that is The Full Monty, which came out through Fox's Searchlight group. Parasite is number 11. The Silence of the Lambs through Orion Pictures is number 10. Seven is number 9. That was New Line. Black Swan, number 8. Fox Searchlight again. American Beauty was number 7.
Keep going.
I mean, I was going to say, you can be mad about Kevin Spacey, but it's a good movie. My Big Fat Greek Wedding, IFC Films. I mean, it's literally there in the title. That's number 6. Slumdog Millionaire came out through Pathé Distribution, number 5. The King's Speech, number 4. That was Momentum Pictures. Dances with Wolves, number 3. Also Orion. The Intouchables, not Untouchables, Intouchables. That's through Gaumont, and that's number 2. And the number 1 highest grossing indie movie of all time. For perspective, Blair Witch pulled in almost $250 million, so about a quarter of a billion. This movie pulled over half a billion. $611 million worldwide. The Passion of the Christ.
All right, so I get where you're coming with this, but I want to go on as a record to say, and aside from one or two of those films, I wouldn't consider a single fucking one of those an independent film. Any movie starring Jim Caviezel or any fucking Full Monty and stuff like that. Like, I get why they're technically indie films, but like, if you would tell me almost all of those movies, I would say not a single one of those strike me as an independent film. I get why they're independent films, but when I think of indie films, I think low budget. And I believe what I meant to say potentially was this was the biggest indie film in terms of how much it made versus how much they spent on it.
It did. So for the record, and I did note it down here, it did have for a while, and I don't think it still does, the world record through the Guinness Book of World Records for top budget to box office ratio. So, and this is something that gets disputed all the time, how much it costs to make. The final production costs before any post-production, any editing, were $60,000. After post-production, that inflated it to somewhere between $250,000 and $750,000. So at the high end, it cost $750,000 to make. That said, again, it made over $248 million. So if you take the $60,000, which is what it cost originally to make, and put it against that, it means that they spent $1 for every $10,931 they made. So yes, it did for the longest time have a record in the Guinness Book of how much it made versus what it cost to make.
Because again, you mentioned the King's Speech in there. For example, King's Speech starring Colin Firth, Jeffrey Rush, Helena Bonham Carter, Guy Pearce, Michael Gambon, this whole litany of major actors with a $15 million budget compared to the Blair Witch Project on its, like you said, much, much smaller budget. I get it. Like, I'm not trying to be upset about it. I get it. And I'm also shocked Ninja Turtles wasn't on that list. Because the first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was also...
Well, for what it's worth, I only counted the 13 down. I didn't look at the rest.
Is Turtles on there? I have to know.
I'll have to go back and find it.
Because I
don't have it pulled up still.
I remember when the first Ninja Turtles came out, and was it 90, 92, something like that?
It is not. It is not in the top... It shows 38 of them here. And it is not in the top 38. So
that's very surprising to me.
Now, for what it's worth, again, because of the distinction for this list, and this is through Wikipedia, by the way, this is not just like some random site, because of the distinction of this list, including things like A24 and Miramax and the Weinstein Company, all as technically, you know, low distribution studios, Fox Searchlight, just a division of Fox. That means on this list, you're getting things like Crash, Sideways, Lost in Translation, Coraline, The Hateful Eight is on there. So basically anything that Tarantino did. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest came through United Artists. No Country for Old Men. Now you're talking about some fairly major productions. Pulp Fiction, which is number 19.
Again, and then when you say, you know, independent film, it's you have to draw that distinction between, I guess, an indie film and a low budget indie film, because you can have an independent film that has a high budget. That's exactly possible.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was just looking. The Passion of the Christ cost $30 million to make.
Right.
I mean, it was not a cheap movie to make, if only just because you had Mel Gibson as the director. Right.
And Jesus was in it.
Well, and Jim Caviezel was not a big deal at the time that movie came out.
He wasn't a big deal until after that movie.
I still don't care about him.
I was going to say he's not a big deal now either, other than to right-wing.
Right, he starred in some new film about child rescue or something.
Sound of Freedom.
Which everybody keeps going, why are the liberals, why do they hate this movie so much? And I'll tell you why. It's because look into the history of the guy. What he said is a lie. Yep. Everything he presented was some kind of false narrative. That's why. Yep. That's why we go, that's a bad movie. Not because, I don't know, we're against saving children? I don't know. That's not what this show is about tonight. This is Extras and Epilogues. We're talking about the Blair Witch Project. Not Jim Caviezel's crazy ass. He'll never be in a Blair Witch film, that's for sure. Probably because they're never
going to... He'll never make it on QVC.
It's probably because they're never going to make another one. So, Blair Witch came out in 1999. Let me start off by saying, directed by Eduardo Sanchez, or was it written by Eduardo Sanchez? It's one or the other.
So Daniel Myrick and Eduardo Sanchez are both credited with writing and directing the movie. Hmm. They co-directed, they co-wrote.
And Eduardo Sanchez, if I remember correctly, I'm going to have to look this up. He's done quite a bit of other things since then. I remember he did a segment on VHS2, I believe. The one with the zombies in the forest, which I actually really liked. I still think VHS2 is the best one in the series.
That is definitely my favorite portion of those movies.
He did. All right. So I'm going to throw this out there real quick. I know this isn't the topic, but he did a really low budget indie alien film called Exists, which came out in 2014. I did see this a long time. Oh, I'm sorry. It's about Bigfoot. Never mind. That's not the movie I'm thinking of. Let me find it. I was aware that movie existed, and I avoided it like the plague.
You and your hatred for Bigfoot.
He directed, look, man, Bigfoot is the most boring.
He does, hey, he doesn't hate Bigfoot. You can't hate things that aren't real.
I believe Bigfoot is real, and I still don't care. It's it's one thing to say I don't care about something that doesn't exist. It's another thing to think something does exist and not care. You know, like people and aliens being on Earth. Go catch last night's episode of I Want
to
Believe.
I was going to say, if you've never listened to I Want to Believe, you just got a good little cross-section of what that show is like. Tanner says, you hate Bigfoot, man. I don't hate him. And then I said, we can't hate him because he's not real. That's it. Yep, that's a cross-section of that whole show.
That's the show right there. Also, that movie was called Altered. Came out in 2006. It's a pretty good movie. Noted. It's not great, but it's pretty good. This movie, though, The Blair Witch Project, he also directed the From Dusk Till Dawn TV series, by the way, which I watched like three episodes of, and it's fine. It's unnecessary. Yeah. It's incredibly unnecessary. Yeah. He also directed Lucifer, the TV show. Oh, well, that's neat.
Huh. Probably episodes, maybe not the whole thing.
It had to be episodes, yeah.
Rarely. I don't know off the top of my head a single show that's had director through the whole thing.
Yeah, he directed two episodes of Lucifer, and he directed five episodes of Supernatural, so, you know.
You often hear that somebody will direct, like, a whole season. Like, I know David Trainer directed the whole first season of Boy Meets World, and then they brought in some different people. Or, like, the Sunny guys, we'll talk about how they had... Fred Savage, I think, did a whole season for them. Yeah. He did a bunch of episodes, but I think at one time he did, like, one whole season. But, yeah, I don't think it's very common. Unless the show gets canceled, like, three episodes in, I don't think it's very common for somebody to direct, like, the whole shebang.
Even a show like, you know, The Mandalorian, everybody always usually credits... what is his
John
name?
John Favreau
for it. But I know for a fact Bryce Dallas Howard has directed episodes.
Yep.
Favreau
doesn't write it all either. I think he and his, I think it's Dave Filoni. I think the two of them are the ones who have kind of like, they're the showrunners. Like, they've adapted it. They have made sure that it stays on track, but then they hand off some of the writing and some of the directing to their friends and people who are good in the industry.
It would be easy to forget, growing up now, if you're a younger listener listening to the show and you missed out on the Blair Witch Project phenomenon, it was a legitimate phenomenon. Like, this is one of those horror films that really transcends pop culture and became kind of an icon in the industry for good reason. I know, Hunter, you said that after rewatching it, you have different opinions on it than you had before. And I kind of agree with you on that, for the record. And I think you and I are going to agree on a lot of things here. But at the same time, Tanner, I agree with you in that I love The Blair Witch Project, and I think it's a fantastic film. It's flawed, but it's great, and I really enjoy it. Let me set the scene for you out there listening to this. Before this film, found footage horror existed. This is not the first found footage horror film that ever existed. The one that I always bring up as the best example I can think of is The Last Broadcast, which was about the Jersey Devil, and is not a great film, if I could be honest with you. Like, it has its place, but it's really not a good film. It's got a terrible twist ending. But when The Blair Witch Project came out in 90... what did we say it was? 1999. Of course, that's the point of it. I was a teenager, and I wasn't actually old enough to go see a R-rated film at that time.
Same.
So I had to have a friend take me. So me and my group of friends went to this. I was obsessed with this movie before it even came out. I loved the idea of it. I was just kind of getting into horror at the time because I had never really watched it before, but I was starting to become a fan. And when I heard about this movie, it looked incredible. I saw the previews on TV. Obviously, the internet hadn't been invented. TVs had just been invented a few years beforehand. And so me and my friends all got together. We had one of us that was old enough. And I'm trying to remember how the story goes, because we all went to go see The Blair Witch Project, but one of us couldn't get into it. Now I can't remember why, because the more I'm thinking about it, how old do you have to be to see an R-rated film?
Is 17 with your parents' approval, 18 otherwise.
Oh, well, never mind then. We were just, that's what it was. The rest of us were just at the cusp of it, because I was barely 17. And one of us that was in the group was not. So he could not see the film. So while we went to go see The Blair Witch Project, he actually went and watched an American... was it American Haunting? Is that not an American Haunting? Is it just The Haunting? The one with Liam Neeson and...
Haunting of Hill House?
That's what it is, but I don't think it was called The Haunting of Hill House. I think it was just called The Haunting.
I think it was just called The Haunting. I think you're right.
Yeah. And it was not a good movie. It was okay. I liked it at the time. Of course, once I found out about The Haunting of Hill House, forget about it. Because that show is better in every way from that film. But point is, he had to go watch that because he could not get into The Blair Witch Project. The rest of us went to go see The Blair Witch Project. And at the time, it was the scariest thing I'd ever seen. There's a part in the film where they're all in the woods and someone's just, they're just hitting against the tent. And I remember, because I lived out in the country at the time, Tanner, I'm sure you did too. And that was the scariest thing to me, was this unknown smacking.
I've got a story that'll one up that just after watching this movie.
I don't have a story. That's it. It was just, I was scared of it. Now, Lindsay.
I have an actual story.
Lindsay has a story because she watched this movie in college with her friends. And as the scary part's about to happen, the pizza man showed up with pizzas and freaked everybody out. So before we get to your story, Tanner, let me give a basic outline of the plot for Dalton, who has definitely never watched this. The Blair Witch Project is about three students, Heather, Mike, and Josh, who are doing a project on the Blair Witch. And is it Burkittsville? I think
Burkittsville, Maryland.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So they descend upon the town, they interview the locals, and then they learn more and more about the witch and what supposedly had happened. They go out into the woods and, you know, try to, I don't know if they're trying to find the witch or if they're just filming for it. They get lost. They lose hope. They start to go insane. And then, we'll get to the ending here in a second, but it's a really well done mockumentary, in the sense that if you showed this to somebody that had never watched wasn't aware of the fact that they made horror films like this, if you just showed this to somebody and said this is real, there's a decent chance, at least through the beginning part, they would believe you. Because to me, the beginning is the best part of the film. When they're interviewing the locals and they're talking to people about the legend of the Blair Witch, that is my favorite part of the film, and I thought it was so well done. Now, before we go any further, Tanner, I do want to hear your story, and I'm going to drink from my tea.
So, this is one of the reasons why this film stuck with me so well and so long, to the point I'm still obsessed with this movie and the lore that came about from the story. I was in fourth grade, and we were doing history in social studies class, and I found out that my family has a connection to the state of Maryland. So, when I find out that this movie that we watched, that some reason we were having a big sleepover at my best friend's house, and his parents thought it'd be a great idea that when this movie came out on VHS, we're going to go rent it for the kids to watch. So they rented it for all those fourth graders. Now, that said, there's nothing super bad in this movie. There's no gore. There's cursing.
Oh, I disagree.
There's some gore at the end, yeah. Yeah. But it's not like Dawn of the Dead style where they're ripping the guys in half or anything. Yeah.
No, but it's there.
It's there.
It's enough to give it a PG-13 rating, in my opinion. Maybe back then.
No, the language covered that.
Yeah. So, we watched this movie, and I feel like, wow, it's in Maryland. This is where my family's from. This is really connecting. The house we were watching at had a big, 100-acre woods right beside it. And we, during the days, we would go out and just run around in the woods.
Was Pooh there?
He was not. The day after watching this movie, we decided to go out in the woods again. We went out further than we'd ever gone before. And Hannah of the Bible would testify to court. We come across an old white house that was abandoned in the middle of the woods. It wasn't two stories, but it was an old white house that he had in the middle of the woods. And my friends looked at me and said, I'm not going in. You go in. And I didn't say a word. Just turned around and walked out. I'm good. That movie was too fresh. That movie... I think that was probably the only horror movie that's ever given me some kind of nightmares. And it was at that point in time where everyone thought it was real. I mean, the internet wasn't as prevalent as it is now. You can't just go on there and find out. Now you go on there, you find out everything's fake right away. Paranormal Activity tried it. Immediately it was debunked. That was not the case of Blair Witch.
That was a huge part of the marketing for this. I mean, that was something that I know we had to touch on, but just as some bullet points off the top of my head, the actors, the three principal actors, were not allowed to do any press. They didn't go on any shows, which was unheard of at the time. You didn't not send the stars of your movie on to Letterman and Leno and all of that. So they didn't do any press. that it went as far as on IMDb to have their profiles, which IMDb at the time was the database for everything. It was taken as gospel. Their profiles listing them as missing, presumed dead for a year from the time that movie was begun production until like, or not begun, like basically for about 6 months after it released. So right. 6 months in the lead up to it and the marketing, and then till about that summer, they were listed as missing, presumed dead. They did attend the premieres, but they weren't shown like in any kind of high profile way. They marketed the movie at Sundance. The filmmakers did, the two guys we were talking about, Daniel and Eduardo. They marketed it by walking around handing out missing posters of the stars, brilliant. Which also mentioned that the documentary would be shown at they showed it at midnight as well, by brilliant. The way. It was shown at midnight at Sundance. So that's another way that it got a lot of attention. Yeah, so much of the marketing, and not just the marketing, but just the ambiance around the movie was spun up to make you believe this is real. I mean, they produced an entire documentary.
Yeah.
That wasn't just the film. They did the whole sci-fi. They showed it on sci-fi.
And
Rustin Parr story.
And I watched it, and I made my mom watch it, and my mom was convinced that it was real. I didn't tell her that it was a movie. Yep. I said, oh, mom, there's this story on, you know, because my mom and I were both into, like, Dateline, stuff like that, so she loved watching stuff like that. That she straight up thought it was real.
That Rustin Parr documentary is really, really good. I go back and watch it.
It was well done. It reminds me a lot of Cannibal Holocaust, by the way, which if you've never seen Cannibal Holocaust, good.
That was one of the first big found footage things, if not the first one.
It was the third.
And it was so realistic.
I knew it was on the line there.
They forced the director of the film to bring the actors into court to prove that they weren't dead because they were so convinced that it was a real thing. It's kind of like there was a Japanese horror film. I forget what the name of it is, but it's something Flowers. It's a series of basically autopsy movies. And they're not real. They're horror films. But they were so convincing that, no joke, Charlie Sheen called the FBI and reported it. And they started this whole investigation. And they had to prove again that this movie was fake. And this movie was kind of the same way. Blair Witch Project was so well done and it was so well marketed that people thought it was real.
I mean, part of that, too, we were talking about that documentary that aired on Sci-Fi. So the Sci-Fi channel picked it up as a way to promote the movie itself. But the first, I think it's the first eight, at the very least, an 8-minute segment of that is what these guys were using basically as the sizzle reel to try to sell the movie in the first place. They were the ones that were going around and or that's what they were using when they were going around and talking to different groups and studios and whatever and saying, like, this is what we're trying to promote. And at the end, they were like, we're not in the business of documentaries. And the guys are like, that's exactly the reaction we wanted. We wanted you to think this was a documentary because it's not. Here it's an actual film and et cetera, et cetera.
And that's – and to be honest, that's the reason it is so iconic is because of the way it was marketed.
100%.
The movie itself, again, I say the movie is good. It's got a good premise. It's well acted from three people that aren't really actors. I mean, this was very much – it's kind of like –
oh, no. No, they are. That's the thing. They got improvisational people. That was the whole point.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so...
Unless you just mentioned it, in which that case I wasn't paying attention.
No, I didn't. This was another thing that I wrote down toward the bottom that I wanted to mention at one point. One of the things that really works about this movie that you were talking about is that they didn't write a script. These guys did not write a script for this movie.
Right.
They wrote a 35-page outline.
Oh, I did know that, yeah. And they just scared
the history of the legend.
Yeah.
Yeah, here's what needs to happen. They left them dead drops throughout the day, but when they put out... They put out a clarion call in I think the magazine was called Backstage. Basically, it was like an actor's magazine that went around at the time, and the advertisement they put out was the kind of thing that you would read now for one of those extreme haunted houses. Like, we need three people who are very good at improvisation and who are okay with getting the shit scared out of them and kind of just taking whatever we do to them for 8 days.
Now, to be fair, though, how they got three. When I said they weren't actors, what I meant by that was, you know, like, take, like, Heather
not
Donahue.
Prominent.
Right. That was Heather Donahue's first movie, was Blair Witch Project.
Right.
It was the first project she did. And I think the other two were the same way. You could not have done this film with somebody like Ryan Gosling, you know, since we're talking about, you know, Barbie and all that stuff. You couldn't take a named actor and put them in this role, because if you had done that, everyone would have known it was fake to begin with, because there's no way that Ryan Gosling's missing and dead. The closest thing I can think of to kind of doing that, you know, kind of wool over the eyes was, and it's not the exact same thing, but when Joaquin Phoenix did that whole rap mockumentary where he had become the Phoenix, you know, you remember he went on Letterman, he was in character the full time.
Garth Brooks. Garth Brooks couldn't become
Chris Gaines.
Chris Gaines, or like Sacha Baron Cohen reached a point where he couldn't do movies anymore because everyone knew immediately who he was.
Yeah,
that's why he had to put, what was it, 15 years between the original Borat and then the sequel, or like 20 years? It was some crazy amount of time.
Yeah, you can't trick people like this again. So this movie really did it the best way with I mean, it was just the perfect storm. Now, that's kind of the history of it. You're talking about a movie. You mentioned it before, but I'll say it again. It had a, what was it, $60,000 before post-production budget. You put it in the notes here.
Yep.
$248 million worldwide gross. It's one of the biggest blockbusters of all time in that way, in that ratio way.
Again, it made over $10,000 for every dollar they spent on it. And a lot of that was because they kept getting their money back.
Right.
They were buying cameras from Circuit City and returning them at the end of their 8 days and getting their money back.
Just smart guerrilla filming right there. I mean,
it really is.
This is one of the most brilliantly made films ever. You can't do this anymore. You know, like, nowadays it kind of seems to have devolved into more of like the prank kind of show. You know, you got guys like Eric Andre and like you mentioned, Sacha Baron Cohen and people like that, that will go out and film prank films that kind of have a similar premise of it's you think it's real. But this is the movie that did it for me. Now, with that said, with the history of the film, let's talk about the film itself. And I'm going to first give the floor to Tanner. No, you know what? I'm going to give it to Hunter real quick. I'll let Tanner do a rebuttal. Hunter, what? We talked about this before the show. You said that after rewatching it, you kind of changed your mind a little bit about it. I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
So I've said a lot of positive stuff in the run-up to this, talking about the history of it. Again, like you said, it's smart guerrilla filmmaking. They used the time frame that they had and the stuff they had at their disposal to make a movie that really feels legitimate in a lot of ways, that feels like it is someone's documentary footage. So many movies would go on after this to do this same sort of thing. We've talked about Paranormal Activity, we talked about Rec, but they all feel like movies. No matter how hard they try to not feel like a movie, they feel like a movie. Like you sat down in a theater with a bucket of popcorn to watch something from a first-person perspective, and that's fine. This is, to me, I don't want to say the only one, but the only one off the top of my head, for me personally, that feels like if you didn't know, if you went into it not knowing what it was supposed to be, you could legitimately sort of fall prey to it. I didn't see this movie in the theater, for what it's worth. The year that it came out, I don't think I saw it at all. I didn't. I might have seen it later that year because it came out in January. So it was on VHS by like October that year. Maybe it was 99. But I distinctly remember the first time I saw this movie, I was alone. There was no one in my house. We lived in a small sort of little hamlet, so we weren't like backed up to the woods or anything, but there weren't a lot of people around. My parents were out for the night. I got it. I turned off all the lights in the house. I shut the door to my room, and I sat down and watched it beginning to end. And I remember then thinking, this is great, but even then knowing this is a movie. Right. It was scary enough because I put myself in the situation. I allowed my sense of disbelief to go away for a little bit and suspend it, and I could enjoy it that way. I've seen this movie probably, counting 2 days ago, 4 or 5 times since then. I know I watched it at least once in college and that sort of thing. I think my biggest problem with this movie is it is diminishing returns.
Yeah,
it is the epitome of once you know the cat is out of the bag, it's so much harder to put it back in and get back into that headspace. And admittedly, when I watched it 2 days ago, it was like noon, so it was the middle of the day. And I don't have the proper ambiance. It's not the right time of year. It's a million degrees outside. But that's my biggest complaint, honestly, is that I feel like you have to put in some work for this movie to do what it's supposed to do. On the surface, and after you're sort of past, once you have the knowledge, it's not real, it's just a movie. It's, to me, the hardest movie to put that back in. Something like The Sixth Sense, after you've watched it and you find out the big twist, which is a little different from this, but bear with me, you can go back and watch it knowing, oh man, there's going to be other stuff to look for because now I know what I need to be looking for. Right.
There's no hints in this movie.
There's no hints in this movie. The biggest criticism I've seen of this movie, and I think I have to agree with it to some degree, is that I understand why at the time it was 86 minutes long, which is kind of short, but horror and comedy both tend to run a little shorter than other genres of films. 86 minutes is not that bad, especially for that time frame, but the whole movie could have been done in 30 minutes and it would have been as effective to me. There's a lot of time spent between. I love the intro where they're interviewing the people. I love getting to know who these characters are when they go out into the woods. But at a certain point, there's so much extra footage of them just tromping around and slowly but surely starting to cannibalize each other. metaphorically, not literally.
That's a different movie. That's Cannibal Holocaust.
I remember as we were rewatching it, that was when, of all the movies we rewatched for this so far, or watched for the first time, Evil Dead Rise in my case, that was the first time that I remember reaching for my phone and going, oh, there it is. You know, there's the moment where I'm checking out, because I don't need all this additional information. I know where this is going. I feel like even if it was the first time I was seeing the movie as an adult, I don't need so much extra time. So I think it's overly long. That's my biggest issue with it for what ultimately takes place. I love what they did, and I love the feel of it. And I think they did an incredible job with what they had to work with. But I don't find myself wanting to rewatch this movie really ever. And I don't know after this that I will. I think I've gotten everything I need to get out of it.
I agree to an extent with that. The more I thought about it, I also love the intro because it's establishing something. It's establishing the lore. It's establishing the feel of the film. When they get to the woods, there is, even though it's probably only 30 minutes, 40 minutes, it feels like an hour and a half when they get to the woods, because it kind of trudges along. Now there are good parts in it. I maintained that, you know, when they find the stones, when they find the sticks, the part where, you know, whatever is hitting the tents and they end up running out. And there's a part specifically in that where she looks to the side and you can't see it, but she says, you know, what is that? What the hell is that? And like, as a kid, that scared the hell out of me, because it's true.
Because you can't see.
It's what you don't see that scares you more than what you do see. Yep. And I think that is an art that is lost.
You know what it was?
Horror directors.
You know what it was that they used to produce that?
I don't know if I want to know, but I want to know.
It was directors.
Yeah. So not only was it the directors, but it was one in particular who was wearing white long johns and like white pantyhose over his head and just like running at full speed.
Oh, that's
and
still
it was
scary.
Enough to like, you could see, you could just see the like blur of him going by.
So the notes they had gotten that day before told him, you know, hey, this is what's happening. Go to sleep at this point in time in the camp, you know, go lay down at this point in time. And then the actors had no idea that the director and producer were coming out to scare the shit out of them.
And
that fear they had was legitimate fear.
And to me, that's best part of the film. Also, to me, that's the in terms of horror, because I still like the beginning better. But in terms of of the pinnacle of fear in this movie, it's that scene. It's not the end. Everybody talks about the end and how much they love it. With it's kind of ambiguous. I mean, that's cool, whatever. But it didn't scare me. Him sitting in the corner, staring at the wall, and them going, "Josh, Mike," and all that. It's not as scary as this part to me.
There's so much lore that you have to remember up to that point about the way that Rustin Parr, it's clearly supposed to be his house, and the way that he killed his victims, and one of them, you know, he made one stand in the corner and not look. Yeah, it's not supposed to even be there. It's a whole thing.
I'll get into that.
Tanner, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this. The thing with the guy is dressed up and running through the woods that Shannon was talking about, you know, we can't see him as the audience. What the hell is that? If I remember correctly, they were actually trying to get that on video. And it just didn't show up because, of course, one of them is running with the camera, so you only ever get what you get. They didn't have like cross coverage like you would have now. And
you know what? You're right, and I think that lends credence to it.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. I remember reading.
If something's chasing me and I've got a camera, I'm not going to take the time to sit there and focus the camera on it.
Right.
I'm running like hell.
Okay, so
I forget now, real quick, who it was, whether it was Myrick or Sanchez, one of the two of the director's writers, if I read correctly, was kind of upset when they went back and reviewed the footage and they were like, oh, shit, we don't have that shot. And that was when they realized, no, wait, this is much better. Like, it took to actually seeing the shot that it was like, oh, this works so much better not seeing who it was.
I mean,
one of the I was just gonna say that to me, one of the biggest problems of a found footage horror film, because if done correctly, I think found footage horror is great, and I think the VHS series really found a way to get around the thing I'm about to say. It's the sense, it's that thing of, if you're out in the middle of whatever, if you're doing whatever, if you're filming things, why the hell are you still filming things when shit goes down? Like, why are you still pointing your camera around whenever? Now, they did try to kind of explain it in this film, because there's a part, if I remember correctly, where I think it's Josh, it might be Mike, but they're talking to Heather, and he's almost taunting her at this point, because they're all starting to lose their mind. And
it's Josh.
And she acts like she knows what's going on. She's got everything under control when she absolutely does not, which leads to that heartbreaking scene. Probably, I think the scene everybody remembers of her looking into the camera and apologizing to their families and stuff like that, which is a great scene, by the way. With the snot, it's weird. But He says to her, you know, I kind of get why you look through, and I'm paraphrasing, I get why you do this. Like, when you're looking through the camera, it's like you're there, but you're not there. So they kind of explain it, but I feel like movies past that have done it better, where they explain why these people are still filming even after, you know, shit starts to go down.
One of the other bigger things about that, why they were still filming with this one, is because they were using the lights off the camera to be able to see what they were doing.
I was going to ask, that was one of the things I was saying. Did they say that? I don't remember them ever saying specifically they were using the lights. What I remember is Heather is the only one who ever really has an excuse for using the camera, and it's twofold. One is what Josh kind of calls her out on with the, you know, I see why you like this now because you don't really have to look at the real world.
It's like,
but the other one was her saying, was her saying specifically, like, we have to document this. We're out here. This is what we came here to do. We have to document this. It's only, that's what her first excuse. It's only after that that Josh kind of steals the camera and then is like, oh, now I get why you like this so much, because you don't really have to be here.
You can, right. You can check out. Way. You check out mentally. Yeah. Which is why, just as a quick side note, I think that is why everyone hated Blair Witch 2. Because they completely stripped...
It's not even close.
It's not close. They stripped away everything that made the first Blair Witch
everything.
Special. And turned it into a basic bitch horror film. But with that said...
More than that.
I want to go out on record, out on a limit, and say that I actually thought the premise of Part 2 was interesting. To treat it as, oh, this was a film, and now all these people are, you know, coming to this town, and kind of... It's like a shit show now. And
yeah, because that was really happening. The
that was really happening.
Sign got stolen like three times.
Right.
I feel like Tanner's going to be the one who knows about this too. I keep throwing stuff to Tanner specifically, but again, correct me if I'm wrong. The 1999 hunting season in a lot of areas got fucked up because people were out in their local woods
looking for the Blair Witch,
either recreating the movie or looking for the Blair Witch or whatever, and people were getting, you know, not hurt, but they could have been.
So this goes back to my earlier story about when I became obsessed with it, like that mentality that everybody had. I had that mentality as a fourth grader in Ballard County. And it got me in trouble actually. But like, there was a point of time where we were going to take a trip to Maryland. Like, we were going to go visit DC and everything, but we were going to Maryland. And I made a point to say, hey, I'd like to go visit Burkittsville.
You bet.
My parents had no idea why, but amongst all my friends, I was the cool one because I might get to go to Burkittsville and all this. And I was like, they're like, man, she's going to get you if you go out there.
No.
Because it was so real to us. Now, to that extent where, like, fourth grader me, like, I wrote out a will. Like, all right, Josh is getting my Pokemon card.
So you were planning for your death ahead of time.
You assumed you weren't going to make it.
You assumed you were going to die. Yeah.
Look, I even back then, I was fat and slow. Robbie gets my Walkman. Chris is getting all the Backstreet Boys CDs.
Oh, my God. It just emits it out loud, too.
Yeah, oh, I ain't afraid anymore. And then, like, so dummy me puts in my locker there in my classroom. My teacher has parent-teacher conferences, and they want to go through everything in my locker, make sure I ain't leaving any homework. And what do they find?
They found your suicide note.
They found a suicide note.
I can't criticize Tanner too much, because once I found out the inspiration for the Silent Hill series was Centralia, Pennsylvania... every time Lindsay and I would go visit Pennsylvania, I would be like, let's go to Centralia. And she'd say, we can't go to Centralia. It's literally like, it's not walled off, but it's illegal to go there because it's dangerous. And I'm like, well, that just means there's going to be less people there. Let's go. I never did get to go to Centralia, but I'm still hoping that one day.
For what it's worth, the people of Centralia do not want you to come to Centralia.
They don't. Well, there's like three people that are still there from what I understand.
I was going to say, they're just sitting on their porches with shotguns just trying to keep people out at this point.
I will also say, going back to Blair Witch, that Blair Witch is one of the most, not copied film, because I don't remember really being any movies that just ripped it off. It's inspirational for sure, but a lot of people, I mean, the found footage genre just blew up after this movie. And it is still,
they didn't invent it, but they popularized it
very much. I think it's less of, and I don't think it was for the best reasons. I feel like a lot of filmmakers and studios simply saw how much money Blair Witch made versus its budget and said, I want a piece of that pie. So then they're churning out, you know, terrible found footage film after terrible found footage film. And I'm pretty sure The Asylum did most of them. But when done correctly, found footage movies are legitimately my favorite horror films. If you can lose yourself in the moment, and I think found footage films do it better than anybody, it's fantastic. The problem is that there are so few great ones, and there are so many bad ones. But the original Blair Witch, despite the same flaws that I agree with, I still love that movie. And to me, this is where Tanner's going to get mad at me, and I'm going to say it out loud. to me, it's the only good film in the series. I didn't like. I didn't like
their sort of new sequel or whatever.
I thought it was okay, but I thought it was just okay. I didn't care
for the ending. Everything up until the end, I liked.
It did have one.
Was kind of,
well. It's let me throw maybe a controversial opinion about that. The main thing I didn't like about the 2016 film, which for the record, we're now talking about Blair Witch and not the Blair Witch Project, because right. Of course that's still confusing. The main thing I didn't like about Blair Witch is looking at it after the fact. It commits the same cardinal sin that it feels like every quote unquote franchise does when it tries to pick up 20 years later. It's kind of just a remake of the original movie,
but with a really unnecessary twist.
Yeah,
wasn't it time travel?
It's not time travel. It's
well, it's a paradox. But yeah. I mean that's the same.
And to be fair, before that movie, that actually existed in the lore,
Which is fine. I'm not saying that they shouldn't have done it. I just don't care for it. Right, because to me, Blair Witch worked best as a ghost story. It's a good ghost story. You're out in the middle of the woods. There's something out there that's scary. But now you've got paradoxes and stuff like that, and like it stops being scary and it becomes convoluted.
My biggest issue with it, outside of the ending, I didn't like, and this kind of goes all together with the ending. One of the best parts that we just talked about from the original, you never see the witch, you never see the monster.
Right.
That is not the case with.
Well, you do.
Yeah, she full on charges at him in one of those scenes.
Well, because there was that was right in the thick of that time frame where you had to have that shot. You had to have the jump scare shot of whatever the thing is running at the camera. And a lot of times they put the damn thing in the trailer. And you go, well, what am I going to the movie for?
Now, did you guys know that they actually did reveal the look of the Blair Witch before that movie ever came out?
Yeah, because it was an action figure, right?
Yep, I'm going to post
it. McFarlane Toys, I think, was doing them.
McFarlane Toys. I remember, I think Bob has this, actually. I'm posting in the chat right now that we use for on Discord.
It's not the thing I'm seeing right now, is it? No, Jesse posted
that. That thing's just creepy. Yeah, there was a full-on Blair Witch figure made by Todd McFarlane, famous for the Spawn series, obviously. Damn. And I don't care for it.
Nope. Same.
Tanner, what say you?
I mean, I want it because of what it is, but I don't like it.
No, it's very...
I remember seeing it at Hastings. It was at the Hastings that we had in Kane for the longest time.
And I wish I had picked it up for the same reasons Tanner did. Jesus Christ, Jesse. I don't understand what is obsession.
Well, he's in a different chat with Bob, so that's probably...
Yeah, he's probably sending it to Bob.
Answer a lot of those questions.
Both freaks there.
for what it's worth, while we're talking about like lore about stuff getting overly convoluted, the first movie has a lot more going on in it than I think some people... I didn't realize until I watched it this time, and again, this is probably the fourth or fifth time that I've seen it. There's like three stories. So there's the Rustin Parr story.
There's the witch herself covered in fur.
The Blair Witch story. Right. And then there's also the ritual sacrifice.
At the rock.
The guys at the rock, Coffin Rock. Yeah. So there's like three things happening there, and they find a way to sort of tie them all in, although they don't really talk about Coffin Rock at all at the end there. It's really just sort of the Rustin Parr Blair Witch thing happening. It's actually one of my criticisms about it when it's all said and done. I feel like all that stuff should have been
one story
more clearly defined. I'm okay with it being different things with it. Okay, there's a legend from the 1700s and there's a legend from the late 80s or 70s or whatever, and then there's also this thing. I'm cool with that, and then sort of it being, oh shit, these are all the same thing. In fact, I think that's a better story for them to find out just before their untimely demise. Oh no, all those things were connected.
Right.
I guess they kind of do that, and I don't necessarily need it spelled out, but I wish it was a little clearer that's what they were trying to do.
I wish they had left it at the first film. Because I feel like the game's fine. Yeah. I'm actually fine with the game.
The game is amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, God, the game.
Now, admittedly, I've never played the game. I've heard nothing good stuff about the game, but I've never played the game.
But part two...
It scares the shit out of me. First time I played it, I had downloaded it on Steam, played it on my laptop, and I was literally in my dining room at 1 o'clock in the morning, every light in the house off, headphones on, playing it, and I'm like right here trying to make sure I don't miss anything, and all of a sudden jump scares just randomly. You never know what it's going to happen.
You live streamed it on Godzilla.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, I looked at it and there was a dog in the trailer, and I went, oh, I can't do that.
Oh, did you know?
Okay, Hunter, to be fair,
I can watch bad things happen to the dog.
There's two endings. You choose what ending happens, and obviously one ending is bad for the dog, but the one that everybody picks is the good ending for the dog.
Hunter,
the dog gets away.
I don't know if you've ever heard of this site. I'm putting it in there right now. Well, of
is
course.
It Does the Dog Die?
Yeah, doesthedogdie.com. Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know that was a thing, and I was like, oh, yep. Hunter will appreciate that.
So to go him. Along with that, because it used to be, and we still do this sometimes, if you go to IMDb, you can actually go to the parental thing, and they're going to put way too much stuff in there, but it will straight up tell you, like, hey, if this is stuff you don't like, it'll be in there. One of my favorite sites that also went with movies on a related note for a long time was runpee.com, and that was the site you go to. So it wouldn't spoil the movie, but like, if you're the kind of person that can't sit for 3 hours without using the bathroom, it would be like, oh, you're going to see this? All right, you have three opportunities. At this point, like, you know, check the time.
Pick this
time. This is what's gonna happen on screen, and you've got 3 minutes. Like, you can leave. We'll tell you what happens. It's not that interesting. And then you can come back.
I think I left during Blair Witch Project because I wanted to get away because I was scared. I was like, I'm going to go get some more popcorn. And I walked out. I was scared. This movie scared me. I can count on one hand the amount of movies that have legitimately scared me. And again, it was only the first time. Like you said, it's only the first time. The first time, if you don't know anything about Blair Witch and you have just the right moment and it's just the right, you know, setting, it will scare you because there are scary parts to it. But once you know the gimmick, it's not scary. Gone GM Haunted Asylum scared me. It's also a found footage film. I can think of Uzumaki. It's not a great film, but it scared me when I was younger. It's a very high bar to me to scare me.
Yeah. Several things. Well, for me personally, Blair Witch is the only movie to scare me. Like, actually, like, the film scared me, not jump scares, but actually
the setting, the ambiance.
Yeah. Second, Hunter, I put in the answer to your question about the dog for the game.
Yeah, I was just reading it, and that tells me enough about it, even though it does make it like, I don't think I can play through all that, man. It's the same reason I didn't play. I started one of the Wolfenstein games, and in the first 5 minutes, they go, "Hey, shoot the dog," and I go, "Nah."
Did you ever see Dog Soldiers?
Yes.
Yeah, that beginning too. Although they at least it's not like it's not a pointless thing. It establishes the bastards and the good guys.
Well, I also saw Dog Soldiers like in college. I was like 20.
Right.
And it was before I was really like invested in that. Also, Sarah's never seen it, and that's the reason I'm never going to recommend it to her.
Right. Well, they're still making the sequel. It's still coming.
I was going to say, I can show her like clips and stuff from the whole movie.
It's a great werewolf. Maybe we'll talk about that one day too. But in terms of the Blair Witch Project, let's get to the epilogue part of the show. God damn. So
it's all right.
This is a hard one to. Oh, go ahead, Tanner. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to, 'cause I never had my rebuttal earlier to Hunter's criticism of it.
That was like 40 minutes ago.
Y'all were talking. I didn't want to interrupt
you. Still on that?
Wagyu,
how long have you been out here?
We're really in the weeds now, touched? Wagyu.
Oh, my.
Anyway, just real quick, this is my biggest thing. So, and I get a lot of people don't like how long it is, especially with like just the filler, quote unquote filler, you know, that takes up so much time.
Yeah,
but for me and my friends that I was with when I watched it, I think that lent more to the authenticity of it, making it seem more real. Like it's not just there in the woods and it's only crazy stuff happening. Like there's that downtime where they're just arguing and being human beings who are getting sick and tired of each other's presence. I think that lent credibility to making it look more real.
Can I rebuttal his rebuttal real quick? Can I go just for a second?
Can I agree with him real quick to a certain degree?
Okay.
Because here's what I was going to say. The context of this, and this was one thing, I mentioned, like, I kind of reached for my phone, and I thought, oh, that's not good. I think we're on the same page in that I think the context for this movie, it came out at the right time in history, at the right time in movies, at the right time in terms of the way that we sort of lived our lives. Because I remember, you know, that story I told about when I watched this movie, house alone, lights off, I didn't have a cell phone to grab, right? I did have a computer and I could have gone on the internet, but that wasn't at a time where I did two things at once. You just didn't do that. I might, you know, play with Legos or some shit while I'm watching TV, but like if you have to be engaged in media, you're going to be doing that. So yeah, I watched it and I didn't ever think, like, I should be doing something else while this is happening, because I wasn't bored. I wanted to know what was going to happen. But having seen the movie multiple times, being out of that frame of mind, and having easy access to, I'm not going to pull it down because it's my camera, but having easy access to go, yeah, I know what happens. Like, for the next 30 minutes, they're just going to get mad at each other.
Right.
That, I think, is the problem. And that's why I say, it's not that I don't like the movie. I just think that in a lot of ways, its time has passed. I think you're going to have a very hard time selling that movie as it is, nothing changed about it, to someone in 2023, even if you convince them, that if you just lie to them and say, this is real, this is a real thing that happened, sit and watch this documentary.
Two things. One, I think you could sell this movie very easily these days if you tweaked it. You got to tweak it and you got to do things differently.
Yeah, that's why I said as is.
Right. The basis.
Like, not as is.
The premise of it is good. I mean, it's, you're going to the woods and it's a ghost story.
Sure.
That's classic. I mean, that's always going to be in style. But I was going to say, I kind of disagree with you, Tanner, in the sense that, yes, it does make it more realistic, but it's also still a movie. Like, you're not going, I mean, they were going for realism. Right, that's what I said. They were going for realism, and they did a good job. But at the same time, that does not necessarily make for a good film to watch as entertainment.
It does for your first time, if this is your first experience with a movie.
Right, but that, like Hunter said, though, that's when you get the diminishing returns. The first time you watch it blows your mind. Every time you watch it after that, now you're just watching it for, you know, the performances, or if there was a monster, the monster. Because there are movies that I've seen a million times. I know Ghostbusters like the back of my hand. There's nothing new in Ghostbusters for me, but I still watch it because I love the comedic performances and I love the ghosts. Blair Witch doesn't really have a lot of things like that. It has the setup, and then it has the premise, but the execution is well done in its own bubble. But once you get out of that bubble, it's a little rough.
I agree. The movie doesn't have a real big... it doesn't have real
rewatchability. Yeah.
That was really hard to say for me.
I know.
But I still enjoy it enough where I can go back and watch it, just because I am in love with the lore so much.
Same. I'm going to watch it again this Halloween. I watch it every Halloween. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very much for me, especially. It's a great movie to throw. Like, if we have a Halloween party like we did before, it's a great movie to throw on in the background, because at any point in time, you can look at that movie and go, I know roughly where we are.
Hey,
right? I know what's going on at this point in time. Before we get to the ending, if there's one thing I meant to mention this earlier, that I can definitively criticize that I don't like, I don't love the plot point of Mike getting rid of the map. I don't love the way it plays out in the movie. I understand that they need a reason.
I kicked that fucking thing into the creek.
And I get that he's going crazy. Like, you know, so legitimately, they were giving them less and less food every day, so it was meant to look like they were running out, and meant to feel like that in a way. It's to me, that whole thing is a little flimsy. He's like, oh, I kicked it into the river. I don't know. I can't really elucidate why I don't like that point so much. But I remember, even as we were rewatching, that was the one that made me go,
why?
That's a little bit Hollywood. Yeah. That one's a little bit movie to me.
I think
there could have been a better...
It's the way he presented it. It's the way he acted during it. It was less...
And I know they needed to build up the tension, because you could have done it as, we lost it.
We lost
the map. Holy shit, we lost the map.
Yeah,
the map is gone.
Heather, what'd you do with the map? You lost it, you were in charge.
They needed them mad at each other.
Yeah, you needed an antagonist.
Yeah, I feel like that's where you could have actually gotten tension out of that with, like you said, she was supposed to be in charge of it. No, I gave it to you guys, because that's the argument anyway.
Right.
But the fact that he eventually just says outright, plus, oh no, I kicked it in, you weren't doing any good with it anyway, you didn't know what you were doing.
Plus,
in circles for days.
I love Heather Donahue in this movie, but she was obnoxious sometimes. And I think that's because she was the main star and she did the most talking.
The point.
But there were parts of the movie that, like, and I get you, maybe you're supposed to feel frustrated with her, like with the other characters, but there were parts when she's screaming at him, like, you know, I knew what to do with the map, you didn't, but I did, and then I thought, you are unlikable. You were coming across as very unlikable.
Yeah.
And you got three people in this movie. Two of them have very little personality. She's really the star, and at points she came across as unlikable, and I chalk that up to the way they filmed it. She probably didn't have a lot of direction and was just going.
Sure.
And it didn't, to me, not everything landed. But with that said, also,
she felt it too, because she had trouble getting roles after this.
So she ended up on It's Always Sunny.
Like you said yesterday, it's like she did one episode of It's Always Sunny and a couple other things, but
she also changed her name. I noticed.
Yeah.
I looked up Heather Donahue, and there is no Heather Donahue. It's Ray Hance.
Nope. Yep.
I was like, okay.
Yeah, I think that was probably necessary because, I mean, you know, especially again with the proliferation of the internet now, you look back at Heather Donahue and there's going to be times that it says she was deceased.
She's dead.
You, again, that's another thing you could not get away with now. You could not just start putting that people were dead on the internet. That's going to become a legal issue at some point.
And that happens a lot. Also, Hunter, you may remember, do you remember in WWF when they did the Bear Bitch Project? Do you remember that?
Man. The name is coming back to me now. I remember there were a ton of parodies of this thing, but I do not remember this specifically.
So Stevie Richards and the Blue Meanie went out to the woods, and it was a rib on Sable, is what it was.
Oh.
And they went out and they filmed the little documentary about the blonde bitch, and it was the Blonde Bitch Project because, you know, of course they had to take shots at Sable after she left and all that.
Sure.
Vince McMahon scrapped it after a week or two because, from what I understand, he didn't understand it. He didn't know what Blair Witch was, so he didn't get the joke. So he,
of course.
He checked.
Of course.
Same thing with Pilot.
That's why Paul Burchill couldn't be a pirate. Yeah, yeah.
Be a pirate.
Hey, if we're going to talk about parodies before we end this thing, we've got to at least briefly mention the Scooby-Doo Project.
That's hilarious. Ethan showed that to me, and I appreciate that. I will forever.
Tanner, please tell me you've seen the Scooby-Doo Project.
I have not.
Oh, it's great.
Oh,
it's fantastic.
So, okay, I'm just going to sell it to you.
And it's real.
So, yeah, it was about a year or maybe later in the year. It was either 99 or 2000. After Blair Witch had come out, that Halloween on Cartoon Network, as they were running blocks of Scooby-Doo episodes, the like interstitials between the episodes were. It was live action footage, but they used like the animated versions of the Scooby-Doo characters running through the like Blair Witch Woods and
Yes.
So you can find them on the internet. They're still out there. They had to apologize for them later because they were showing them at a time that people were like, hey, my kids are still watching this, and they're getting because I mean it shows like, you know, Shaggy standing in the corner and everyone else like screaming, and people were freaking out, and so later they were like, hey, sorry, we should have maybe said we were gonna do this.
You could just hear all through the studio,
that's not good.
So before we get to the epilogue part of this, as we do every week on the show, we give a thumbs up or thumbs down for the movie we're talking about. This one's going to get an enthusiastic thumbs up from me, if nothing else for the nostalgia that I experienced with this movie and how much it scared me the first time I watched it. Things don't always, you know, hold up the further you go. Sailor Moon, the Mario cartoon, stuff like that. But I still hold a special place in my heart for it, and therefore I cannot not give it a thumbs up. We'll go to Tanner. No, Tanner's definitely a thumbs up. I don't even have to ask.
It's two thumbs up.
He gave it two thumbs up.
Because how bad it scared me, because the lore that it built and that it's still continuing to build, that I think everybody should go check out, including the video game from the Bloober team. As I've got here, the Blair Witch Hunt the Killer game set, season one, is fantastic.
Just avoid the second movie.
Avoid the second movie. Go watch the third one.
You can watch the third one, but avoid the second one.
Yeah.
It's bad. Bad movie.
There were supposed to be three of those, by the way. I don't know if you guys knew that. After Book of Shadows, they were planning a third movie, and Book of Shadows was so bad that it got scrapped. It
killed the franchise until 2016. The latest stuff, yeah. And again, it was a good film. It was not a great film, the 2016. No. I enjoyed it. I had a lot of problems with it. Hunter, what about you?
We watched the theaters together.
The Blair Witch Project, the original, is going to get a single thumbs up from me. I'm not going to give it a thumbs up and down. I'm just going to give it a single thumbs up and call it good. I do think it's worth watching, and I think if you've never seen it, I mean, granted, if you're listening to the show and you've never seen it, we've ruined it for you. We've said it before. Do not come to the show and expect a non-spoiler discussion.
This is the spoiler show.
That's not it. But even if you have seen it, I do think it's worth going back and watching at least once. The thing is, though, again, you're going to have to do a little work. You're going to have to get yourself in the right ambiance. And I'm not just talking about pulling the shades, watching it in the dark and silence and, you know, put your phone in another room or whatever. Make sure you're in the right headspace to go, okay, I'm going to consciously try to remind myself that this, or try to not remind myself that this is a movie. that this is a documentary. This is being presented to me in a way that actually is what happened. I remember telling Sarah when it started up, I love that it still has the super jumpy film grain. Mm-hmm. You can tell it's low budget. Like, it looks like it's somebody's actual footage. So the movie does some legwork for you there, but you have to do a little bit to go with it. And that's why I can't call it great, but I can call it good.
You know, there are some movies that do the found footage thing and don't come across nearly as authentic as this. I mean, it's hard to come across as authentic sometimes, but there was one especially I was super excited about, and it was called, I think it was called Frankenstein's Army. And it was like a World War II movie about this crazy Nazi doctor who creates these freak of nature monsters that the Allied forces have to fight. Great fucking concept. And then I watched the movie and it's found footage. I'm like, well, how are you going to do a found footage movie in World War II? I mean, I guess they had film cameras, but like, the idea that you're carrying it around and filming everything. Well,
all
then
the time.
The worst part of it is it was a modern camera. So everything looked modern. You know what I mean? It had,
yeah, of course.
It had high depth. Yeah. And like, right. That instantly ruins it. That's what's great about Blair Witch is, like you said, this feels like a legitimate like camera crew went out there and filmed this low budget.
If you wanted to make the Blair Witch Project again today, if you wanted to remake it, it is doable.
It's a TikTok.
But not on your iPhone. Not on your iPhone. That's the thing. You could do it that way, and it's going to look super great. But going back and getting, I mean, what they gave the crew, if I recall reading correctly, were Sony Hi8 cameras. You can still buy the old school. I mean, you're going to have to go to eBay and get it from somewhere like that, or like a you know, a dealer in older electronics. You can still get a Sony Hi8 camera. You can still pop an old VHS tape into it, charge the battery up, and, well, not charge it. You're going to have to buy batteries for it, which is another criticism of the movie. Did they have batteries to run for that long? They were not supposed to be there that long. Anyway,
they brought extra batteries. They didn't mention.
Yeah, they had extra ones. Hey. They didn't get that slime all over them.
Hey,
but yeah, you could do this. It's doable.
Epilogue for this one's going to be very hard because this movie pretty much spelled out everything. The kids were never found, and then they did the sequels. That the second one destroyed the mythology of the first one, and then the third one kind of
try to get continues it back.
Tried to get it back, right? So this one is hard to say what happened afterwards. In my opinion, the only thing that could happen is those kids stayed gone forever. They became part of the legend, and some new dumbass kids went out there to try to find them, and then the cycle repeats. That's it to me. That's it.
2016. I mean, that's what happened. So yeah,
that's a very easy question for me to answer because I've done everything that you can. I mean, after those three go missing, there's constantly more children going missing. You know, one woman's kid goes missing and she contacts a detective agency to find a child. Another kid goes missing directly, I mean, talking immediately after the first three, and that's the basis of the video game. And then, obviously, there's everything with Russ and Parr, and the lore of this franchise is ever expanding. That's the true epilogue of it, is the video games, board games, documentaries, everything that took place afterwards.
Well, so why would you ever live there? If you have kids and you're living in that area and kids keep going missing and disappearing, why would you stay there?
That's the good question, isn't it? It's almost like something's not letting them leave.
I think I just answered my own question, but I was going to say I have a kind of a similar question. If everyone who goes into that woods is susceptible to this thing, how did anybody find the footage from the first movie?
Because
why did they allow
it was buried somewhere else, not there.
So why would the implication then is that some unseen force?
I take that back. It was buried in the under the foundation of Rustin Parr's house. The house you see them in the movie.
Uh-huh.
Is Rustin Parr's house. I mean, Hunter talked about it earlier. After he was After he was put to death, and I'm talking to the fans now. After he was put to death, they burned his house down because of the negative image that the house had. No one wanted to live there anymore, and it was disgusting and gross. All of a sudden, it's back. And then now they're finding the footage from these teenagers that went missing in the woods, or college students, maybe not teenagers, but these college students that went missing in the woods. It's actually under the foundation of the house that got burned down back in the 60s. You know?
Why is anybody under the foundation of that house?
I don't know.
That's what I'm saying. That's the thing where I feel like if I think too deep about it, it's
explained in one of the documentaries, and it's actually
okay.
I, Yeah, okay. it is explained. I just had thought in my head. I can't remember.
I mean, I'll say this. I read a book a couple of years ago by a guy named Thomas Hoivold. He's Swedish, Norwegian. It's called Hex. It has a really bizarre, interesting premise. It was really hard to get into in the first couple chapters because he kind of just dives in without explaining it. But it follows a similar pattern. This northwest town in the U.S. is haunted by the ghost of this woman. I think her name was Catherine Weiler. And rather than everyone just kind of, you know, whatever, because she's scary, but she won't, like, hurt you or do anything to you. You just have to be aware that she can appear anywhere at any given point in time. They intentionally, like, force anyone who tries to move in out, because if you try to leave after you've lived there for a significant period of time, like, you'll start having these blackouts and stuff, and you can't leave for a while. They concocted a whole thing around it, and they literally have an agency that sort of, like, reports on where she is and what you need to do and this and that. And it was kind of cool. And I always thought, that's the epilogue that I want for something like this. That's really why the whole reason I'm even bringing this up is that I want the story of who found the footage and how did they handle that next. And I know that the existing story is that, well, more and more bad things keep happening. I'm actually more interested in, like, who's smart enough to come up with a way to circumvent all of this. Like, I almost want a thriller and not another horror movie in a way.
Oh, didn't they say in the original that, or at least it was hinted at, that Rustin Parr is the one that killed the three in the first movie?
That, no. I don't know.
No, Rustin's way, way dead. They call her, I mean, she's the Blair Witch, but they call her Ellie Kedward.
Which is the poorest anagram of Kelly Edward. Yeah. That I've ever. Now, and it is Kelly Edward is an actual, like, legend of someone who died up around that area.
Yeah. So,
Kelly Edward, what can we call her?
It's also Kelly important Edward. to note.
Or Ellie Kedward.
Ellie Kedward, yeah. It's also important to note that,
well, also,
really and truly, it's not the Blair Witch that's doing all this physically. She's causing it to happen. And this is according to the lore. I mean, this is video games, movies, documentation of it, documentaries and everything. She takes an acolyte, which is what Rustin Parr was, basically. She was controlling Rustin Parr and making him doing these things. And after he completed the task, that's when he came back to town and said, I'm done.
I'm finally finished.
And that's he takes on a persona that in this universe is called Carver, is his name. And it's basically, he looks like a mountain man that's covered in mud and sticks. He's just walking around killing people.
That's just Bigfoot again. You're just going back to Bigfoot. Everything revolves around Bigfoot with you.
He's average height. He's regular foot.
He's regular foot.
He's, oh God. All right, that's it. See, I thought that Rustin Parr, I thought that it was insinuated that his ghost is the one that did it. Like, it was his spirit that was doing the awful stuff. But I guess they really didn't give much of an answer in the first film. It was
No, it was explained later in documentaries and everything.
God. It's my favorite thing. When you watch a movie, but then you have to watch the expanded universe to understand things that happen in the movie.
I was waiting. Thanks, General Grievous.
Shannon, please let people who enjoy the expanded universe enjoy it.
If I could click hold on.
Look, if it makes any of you feel any better, I just changed Cody's name in the group chat to Regular Foot.
Tanner, can you hear this real quick when you say something like that? Can you hear this?
Yeah, I hear it.
Yeah, you know what it is. That's going to be it for us on this episode of Extras and Epilogues. What do we got up next week, Hunter? What do you think?
Good question. I don't know. I was just gonna mention that to you. Well, I mean, I'm assuming Tanner won't be back next week. We tend to rotate our guests, but should we let Tanner pick?
Yeah, let's let Tanner pick.
All right, Tanner. I'm gonna
give him five options.
I'm gonna give you five options, and you tell me what we should watch next week, and then we'll have to figure out who comes on with us. All right. So if we're gonna continue to pull from our list from 1999 from Brian Raftery's, I'm never gonna get that guy's name right. Book Best Movie Year Ever. If we're gonna stick with fairly prominent stuff that's not kind of what we've already done, I'm thinking we should do either The Matrix. Cruel Intentions. Election. Galaxy Quest.
Oh my.
or Fight Club?
Shannon, this is a series show. I'm not going to pick Galaxy Quest because I want to be a part of that one, actually.
Okay.
Go with Matrix.
That's the easy Matrix one. Yeah, we could do Matrix. All right. We could probably get convince Kaz's ass to be on that one.
Kaz would be a good one for that because we've not had him on yet, and I think he'd be good for that. Also, importantly, I'll say it here and now, I have never seen The Matrix.
Oh, this is going to be great for you. I have a story about The Matrix, never too. I'll save it for next week. Never. All right.
So for whatever reason, I didn't see it in theaters, and it was I remember distinctly, it was loaned to me on DVD form in the year 2000. I had it for 3 years in my bedroom, never watched it. Gave it back to the person, was like, yeah, it was great, thanks.
That was me with Devil May Cry 4. Bought Devil May Cry 4 brand new, stayed sealed in the package till I traded it in.
Sat sorry, on it. Ethan. Yeah.
All right, that's all next right. week. We're talking about The Matrix with Keanu Reeves, Carrie Ann Moss, and Larry Fishburne. That is going to be next week.
And maybe Kaz.
And maybe Kaz Fishburne. We'll see what happens. But for this week, last night, new episode of I Want to Believe, go check it out. We talked about the congressional hearing about UFOs and aliens and UAPs and all that. That's last night. Check that out. There will be no show tomorrow because it is my birthday, and I'm just not doing one for the record.
Yeah.
Just not doing one. And then Friday may or may not be Time of Horses. Hunter won't be there, so we'll see if we're going to do that. Either way,
that is correct.
Next week, we're talking about The Matrix right here on Extras and Epilogues. Until then, the balcony is closed. Thank you, guys. Have a good night. And we'll see you next week.